On this 24th day of May 2011 in San Diego, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Chapter 2, Contents of the Gita Summarized, text number 30. Dehi nityam avajoyam.
Dehi sarvasya bharata.
Tasmat sarvani bhutani.
Natvam
shotitum arhasi.
Dehi nityam
avadhyoyam.
Dehi sarvasya bharata.
Tasmat sarvani bhutani.
Natvam
shotitum
arhasi.
O descendant of Bharat, he who dwells in the body can never be slain. Therefore, you need not grieve for any living being. Purport. The Lord now concludes the chapter of instruction on the immutable spirit soul. In describing the immortal soul in various ways, Lord Krishna establishes that the soul is immortal and the body is temporary. Therefore, Arjuna, as a Kshatriya, should not abandon his duty out of fear that his grandfather and teacher, Bhishma and Drona, will die in the battle. On the authority of Sri Krishna, one has to believe that there is a soul different from the material body. Not that there is no such thing as soul, or that living symptoms develop at a certain stage of material maturity resulting from the interaction of chemicals. Though the soul is immortal, violence is not encouraged, but at the time of war it is not discouraged when there is actual need for it. That need must be justified in terms of the sanction of the Lord and not capriciously. Om Ajnana Timurandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmidatam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So this verse nicely summarizes the essential message that Krishna is trying to convey here to Arjuna in these last 20 verses, beginning with text 11. And that is that Arjuna shouldn't lament. Remember the first words of his instruction, Ashochan and Vashochastvam. You're lamenting for what is not lamentable, namely the imminent death of the bodies of your worshipable guru and your teacher and Bhishma Dev and others. So he ends with the same idea, Natvam Shoti Tamarasi. And in fact, the whole teachings then in text 66 of the 18th chapter, Ma Shuchaha, don't lament. So what is this lamentation? This shochitam. This is an emotion that is symptomatic of ignorance, actually, because the soul itself is indestructible, and when we lament for things that we have lost or might lose, or a million other things that you know can cause lamentation. This is a sign of really the mode of ignorance, because we don't really own anything. That's the first instruction of the Isha Upanishad. Isha Vashimidam Savam Yat Kintichigandhigat, that everything is owned and controlled by the Lord. That what do we separately actually own? Everything is on loan, you know? Everything is on loan to us. We're given these bodies and we're given the relationships with the bodies on a temporary basis. Who are they given by? Well, they're given by higher forces. We can obviously say that did we all plan to get born in a certain body? Did we all plan that we're going to have a particular human body in this place and we'll have to at least facilities? It's been given to us. This is why the Vedic culture explains that we actually are debtors as soon as we take born. Devarshi Bhutap Nirinam Patrinam. There's a list. The devas, the people, other living entities, the rishis or the sages, those who are wise, who give knowledge. Knowledge is an essential thing in this society. It's existing. Hare Krishna. You know, it's given to us. Our parents teach us. Our teachers teach us, right? And forefathers for giving us life. So, but no, we just say, well, this is, you know, the general tendency is, well, this is what I have. This is whatever I can grab and put into my control. I can enjoy. This is the demonic mentality. This is the mentality based on ignorance. And it's really a thieving mentality because we're claiming what really doesn't belong to us. Ultimately, what do we own? Mrityu sarva harascham. Krishna takes it away by force at the time of death. So, is it really ours? So, there's nothing to lament for the death of anyone, really, ultimately. But what is of concern, if you will, is the destination of the soul, or the fate that we make for ourselves. That we should pay attention to. Not the fact that we're all going to die. You know, that's of concern, but it's not ultimate concern. What's ultimate concern is how can we act in this life to have the best future, to have the best future birth, or if we're fortunate, no birth in this world. So, but as far as the bhutani, this is sarva bhutani. Bhutani are created living beings. Bhutani is kind of the what we call organisms. An organ. Prabhupada doesn't use that word, but he means that. A combination of a soul and matter. And there's all kinds of organisms. There's animals, right? There are plants. There's all kinds of, they're organisms. Any place you have a soul combined with some kind of body and there's a symptom of consciousness, that's an organism. Now, generally, the term is reserved for more complex beings, you know, all kinds of cats and dogs. You have some organs.
That which has come into being, Bhuta means that sometimes it includes even the creation.
Yeah, in this case, it's this living entities that are born. It's described in this particular context. So, provided that we're working, that we're acting in concordance with the will of the Lord, there's nothing to lament in the course of that. This is a very important point because in say some enterprise of this say Krishna conscious movement, just look at the history of it. Now, Srila Prabhupada came here. In 1965, and there was no material manifestation. In other words, all he had was a couple of dollars in his pocket and a few books, and one or two contacts in the Northeast area, Pennsylvania, New York. You know, but he had the order, he had the mission to spread the chanting of the holy name, Lord Chaitanya's mission, his teachings, his spiritual master. Right, that was his mission. So. From a material, he'd already tried and failed, actually, in India to do it, you know, basically. He made a little headway, but he certainly, you know, it was very difficult. So, an ordinary person, if you try to start a business over a period of 20 or 30 years, and at the end of all those 20 or 30 years, you have $10 in your pocket, you know, and not much else, you know, say, oh, I failed, you know. And you lament, and most people would say, "Well, you know, I blew it. I didn't succeed." But the wonderful thing about spiritual endeavor is that the effort itself is the success. Just to make the effort sincerely to put all your life and soul—that's already success, whether something external happens or not. And Prabhupada knew that, and therefore he never lamented. See, because lamentation is a paralyzing emotion. What was the description of Arjun? He dropped his bow. He was trembling. He was sweating. He was crying. This is a symptoms of paralysis, right? Because he was completely in anxiety, in conflict. He was conflicted. Because on the one side, he has his great friend and his, you know, the Supreme Lord, his advisor, Krishna, wanting him to do something. On the other side, he had his heart, his gut. You know, I don't want to see my worshipable friends and my Lord and everything, you know, kill Dronacharya, his teacher. So he's conflicted, you see. So Krishna is speaking this almost like a psychotherapist, you know, to resolve the conflict and to really evaporate Arjuna's concern, his lamentation, which was all based on material concerns, based on ignorance. He's enlightening him, as we see here, as we're reading. Arjuna is becoming enlightened, and if we're also reading properly, we're becoming enlightened, that there's nothing to lament for in this world, provided that we're working according to the orders of God. It's as simple as that. And so that's the basic message here, that we should understand we are eternal. Within the body is the dehi. Dehi means that which is inside the body, inside the deha. That's the embodied soul, is eternal, can never be killed in every body. Therefore, you should not lament for anyone. And we should also not lament for anyone. But we should also try to come to that platform. Unless we come to the Brahma-Bhuta stage, unless we elevate our consciousness, where we can really feel ourselves to be spiritual beings at every moment and act on that platform, then we'll fall back into this consciousness of bodily concept of life, mental concept of life, and therefore there'll be so much to lament for and fear about. You know, I remember growing up as a child. There was this general dread in the air. You know, this was in the '50s and sixties. You remember? You know what it was? Who can guess?
The threat of atomic war.
Thermonuclear war. It was a real threat. It's still a real threat, but they put it in the background. But you know, we were in this Cold War with Russia, and you look at the map. I mean, what does the kid know? You look at the map. Oh my God, their country is like four times as big as us. You know, I mean, they're actually like 1/10 as strong. You know, but they look bigger. You know, all red. You know, and then there's Red China. And says, God, it's half the world. You know. And they're menacing, you know, and then you read in the books, yeah, Khrushchev is going to come to get you, you know. He's this big bear of a guy, you know, he's pounding his shoe at the UN, and then they show the pictures of oh my God, they show the 50 megaton bombs blowing up. They did, you know, they tested these in the air for a while, till all the radiation started to be there, and they had a treaty. You realize how frightening that is? Every kid in America was looking at that. Then we'd have drills. You'd come under the desk, you know, duck and cover. So you're growing up with this fear, shochitam, you know. The same thing is going on now. They had the boogeyman, Osama. You know, can you imagine all the kids had nightmares, had to run into their parents' rooms to sleep in the bed? Osama's coming to get me. Look what he did. He blew up those towers, you know. Oh, God. So this is the demons do that. They try to scare you to control you. And so this is very important. If you can escape that fear, shochitam, anxiety is a kind of fear. It's internalized fear. All the time you're anxious, you've got to take a pill. You know? So, natram shochitam arasi, for anything, do not lament. And at the end, just surrender to me, you have nothing to fear. Don't lament. So this is very good instruction. Now, this is the end of this lesson, as Prabhupada says. It's 20 verses on the soul. It's worth learning these. You know, becoming very... The most quoted verse, I'll tell you if you're interested in just learning one verse, is number 20. The jayate mrite vakadacham nayam budva bhavita vanabhuya ajo nitya shastratoyam purana mahanyate handimane shirire. That basically says the whole thing. You know, for the soul is neither birth nor death. It doesn't come into being, never came into being, will not do, no, new ones won't come into being. The souls all exist as eternal as Krishna. We exist on that. There's not new souls coming into being now. So that Aja, unborn, Nitya, eternal, Shatra, the permanent, Purana, ancient. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Just think about that. We have all been living from time immemorial, billions and billions of lifetimes. We may have forgotten. But that's Purana. And then the key thing, which he reiterates here, is on the battlefield, when the body is slain, the soul is not slain. We have this destiny. Yes?
How come there's more beings on the planet than before?
Are there really? I mean, there may be more human beings.
Oh, I see.
You know, because you have to see that all these insects, they're all this is as much souls as we are, you know? And also we have to realize that this is just one planet. There are also other higher planets, lower planets. There are all kinds of places where there are living entities. I'd like to give this example. It used to be that, you know, when I grew up, that you can sterilize something by a certain amount of heat, right? I used to work in a hospital. They had something called the autoclave. where they put all the instruments, you know, they operate where they put them in the autoclave, sterilize, and then you don't have to worry, they're clean. Steam and whatever, you know. And it works, the bacteria is killed. So the idea was that after a certain temperature, nothing can live. Therefore, the sun, there's no life there. No question of it. It's too hot, way too hot, right? Moon, it's too cold, you know, like they had to say. So then they discovered, right here, right off the coast here, there's a huge, deep trench. You know, there's a 10,000 feet or more. And at the bottom of that, or maybe it's some other place in the ocean, they have these volcanic vents that very, very hot. And because of the pressure, you can heat it up, you know, way past boiling, way past the autoclave temperature. And they found that there's little bacteria in there. You know, living entities. In other words, that doesn't prove that the living entities are on the sun, but it means that they have to, that their whole idea has to be torn up. So there are living entities in the sun, there are living entities everywhere, and sometimes they're manifest, sometimes they're not. So that's the answer to your question. Okay, anything else? Yes?
In a few classes back, I asked about like staying awake from the dream of material consciousness. Would reading these 20 verses on the soul on like a daily basis be a nice way to...
It's a very good basis, yeah. And the thing about this is the way... This is the first lesson for anyone. In other words, it helps you in your teaching to new people. You know, the first thing you have to learn is that you're not the body; you're pure spirit. You know, aham brahmasmi. This is a nice little phrase. Aham brahmasmi. I am spirit, not matter. And the thing is that has implications. It's not just something to turn over in the mind. That has profound implications for how you lead your life. Because if I'm not this body, then there's no point in my completely absorbing all my interests and my value in things of the body. And really the discipline of Krishna consciousness or yoga means to minimize the involvement with the body. You dress simply, you eat simply, you know, you minimize your material needs, and you cultivate this higher knowledge. Simple living, high thinking. That's another nice phrase, you know. And by doing that, you cultivate this awareness throughout the day, throughout your life. The whole idea is from when you wake up till you take rest, you're meant to be in this awareness that I'm spirit, not matter. And as a pure spirit, I'm meant to serve the Supreme Spirit. And the Supreme Spirit is the Supreme Person. You know? So you know, that's the whole idea. And whatever, the body is simply a tool. It's a nice machine, very important machine, so we shouldn't minimize. You take care of it, you know, keep good health for the purpose of serving Krishna, serving God, and getting out of the body. No more material bodies. What a wonderful thing. You know, as you get older, you realize really what a wonderful thing it would be not to have this body weighing down on you, you know. When you're young, you ever see how kids, when they grow up and they first can walk, And within no time they can run. Suddenly they discover their body. Whoa, I can run, you know. And the mother has to keep more care about it. And then they get bicycles and they're off, you know. And it's just a great discovery. They're discovering, you know, how wonderful the body is, you know. But it has limits, you know. It has tremendous limits, you know. All right, let's go on. So Krishna changes gears now. Now he's speaking again, this little interlude as a chatriya, one chatriya to another. Swadharmam api chaviksha.
Swadharmam api chaviksha.
Navikam pitamarhasi.
Navikam pitamarhasi.
Dham yadhi yudhatreyonyat.
Dham yadhi yudhatreyonyat.
Chatriyasya navidyate.
Chatriyasya navidyate.
Considering your specific duty as a chatriya, you should know that there is no better engagement for you than fighting on religious principles, and so there is no need for hesitation. Purport. Out of the four orders of social administration, the second order for the matter of good administration is called Kshatriya. Chat means herd. One who gives protection from harm is called Kshatriya. Triyate, to give protection, just like we sing every morning. Samsara dava naralita loka tranaya. That's the same verb. He saves, someone who saves you from the fire of birth and death. So here, the Kshatriya generally saves the weaker members of society from harm from the rogues and the dacoits and the evil ones. The Kshatriyas are trained for killing in the forest. A Kshatriya would go into the forest and challenge a tiger face to face and fight with the tiger with his sword. When the tiger was killed, it would be offered the royal order of cremation. This system has been followed even up to the present day by the Kshatriya kings of Jaipur state. The Kshatriyas are specially trained for challenging and killing because religious violence is sometimes a necessary factor. Therefore, Kshatriyas are never meant for accepting directly the order of sannyas or renunciation. Nonviolence in politics may be a diplomacy, but it is never a factor or principle. In the religious law books, it is stated, Ahaveshu mitonyonyam jighang santo mahichitaha yudhamana param shakya swargam yan chaparan mukaha yagyeshu pashavo brahman hanyante satatam vijayi sanskrita kira mantraischa tepi swargam avaptuvan. In the battlefield, a king or kshatriya, while fighting another king, envious of him, is eligible for achieving the heavenly planets after death, as the Brahmins also attain the heavenly planets by sacrificing animals in the sacrificial fire. Close quote. Therefore, killing on the battlefield on religious principles and killing animals in the sacrificial fire are not at all considered to be acts of violence, because everyone is benefited by the religious principles involved. The animal sacrifice gets a human life immediately without undergoing the gradual evolutionary process from one form to another. And the Kshatriyas killed on the battlefield also attain the heavenly planets, as do the Brahmins, who attain them by offering sacrifice. There are two kinds of swadharmas, or specific duties. As long as one is not liberated, one has to perform the duties of his particular body in accordance with religious principles in order to achieve liberation. When one is liberated, one's swadharma, or specific duty, becomes spiritual and is not in the material bodily concept. In the bodily conception of life, there are specific duties for the Brahmins and Kshatriyas respectfully, and such duties are unavoidable. Swadharma is ordained by the Lord, and this will be clarified in the fourth chapter. On the bodily plane, swadharma is called varnashram dharma, or man's stepping stone for spiritual understanding. Human civilization begins from the stage of varnashram dharma, or specific duties in terms of the specific modes of nature of the body obtained. Discharging one's specific duty in any field of action in accordance with the orders of higher authorities serves to elevate one to a higher status of life. So, Krishna now is lauding swadharma. Arjuna's, clearly his swadharma is to fight. He's a kshatriya through and through. But he's neglecting that. So even on that level, he's also acting, will act unnaturally. He was proposing that he would go out into the forest and beg. In other words, take sannyas. But he's not suited for that. Later on, he complains in the sixth chapter, I don't think I can go into the forest and sit and meditate. So he's clearly not. He's representing us in that regard. That to all of a sudden give up your natural propensity, your psychophysical, the work according to your psychophysical nature is too traumatic, and it's not conducive really to progress along the path. The idea is that there's a path. There's a path. Krishna has created a system where you can gradually and naturally progress spiritually in what is called Daiva Varnashram, or Daivi Varnashram. Varnashram means a combination of two words, Varna and Ashram. Varna means your occupation, and there are generally four that are mentioned. The Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra. Brahmins are the intellectual class, the teachers, the advisors to the king. The Kshatriyas are the rulers and military administrators in general. The Vaishyas are those who make money or who farm. They create wealth. And the Shudras are the servants. They serve the higher classes. Now, it only works, it can only be satisfying for each member if Krishna's in the center. This is explained nicely in so many verses, but the one that comes to mind, Atat Pumbhya Dvija Shrestha Varnashrama Vibhagasha Svanustitasya Dharma Sasanksidhi Aritoshanam. Now, the word Svanustitasya means Suanushitasya, nicely practicing. All of your situation in these eight. Well, there's another one. There's also the ashram. The ashram generally is brahmacharya, grahastha, vanaprastha, sannyas. Student life, household life, retired life, and renounced life. So all of them together, if they're centered on pleasing Hari, if there's a spiritual element, in other words, they're centered on Krishna consciousness, sang siddhir, Hari toshanam. Perfection is there if Hari is satisfied. Otherwise, it becomes corrupted. And we see that in India. If it's just a social construct for the higher classes to lord it over the lower classes, then that's a complete corruption. You know, the Brahmins generally have to be austere and learned. They have to be renounced, you know, clean, self-controlled. There's all of these qualities that the Brahmins have. It's by quality, not just by birth. And if they really have that, then they can guide society like a head guides the body. The Kshatriyas are generally passionate, but they need to be allowed to be controlled by the Brahmins. You know, they have to hear and take advice and generally follow it. If the Brahmins are learned and their motive is simply to guide society, that means they're genuinely austere and renounced, then they can provide good instruction for the Kshatriyas. The Kshatriyas also have to be religious. That's one of their quotes. They have to be moral. The real problem is that the Kshatriya has become corrupted in modern society. The Brahmins become corrupted, you know, and the rest of the society simply suffers. Now you have a society, capitalism, that's the Vaishyas in control. You have people whose only motive is to make money, you know, and then by any means necessary. That's on the demon side. That's the demonic, you know. It doesn't matter, poison the earth, you know. They've got these new things. I got to write to New Vrindavan. You know, it is a problem with this fracking of the gas. You ever heard about that? Yeah. Anyway, you know, there's a constant, you know, in the society that they build up, there's a constant need for energy, right? So generally now oh my God, global warming. We're burning all this oil and coal, you know, and there's also natural gas. So in order to try to get away from coal and oil, you have to have some other means of energy. Well, is nuclear going to work? After Fukushima, you can forget about it. You know, that radiation is coming over us, unfortunately. You know, look at the maps. Yes. Anyway, but that's not going to work. So, okay, if we can just find a whole lot more natural gas. So they found this huge quantity of natural gas, but it's embedded in this shale rock. All over the Northeast, New York, Western New York, all of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and it's part of Ohio. If you look at the map, there's a huge bed. They haven't been able to get that gas out until now. They've developed this process. But it's horrendous. They dig way down, and they pump this water. They crack open this shale rock, and the gas comes out. But in doing that, there's a tremendous amount of wastewater and chemicals. And it gets all into the groundwater and poisons and radioactivity and everything. It's horrific. So this is called Ugra Karma, you know. So what about who? There's human beings behind that. There's somebody who's planning it all out, figuring it all out, spending a lot of money, right? Who are those guys? You know, these are the demons. These are the millionaires and billionaires who run things, and they don't care. They don't care if the groundwater gets polluted. They have all kinds of scientists they pay off and propaganda. Oh, no, it's fine. You know, it's like cigarettes were fine. They'd have doctors to say, oh, there's no proof. I remember the ads in Life magazine. There's no proof it causes cancer. It's good for you. I'm smoking them. And you get all these, you know, these kids growing up in the 50s, 60s, and even today, smoking cigarettes. It's poison. It should be outlawed. So anyway, that comes from, gross ignorance. There are still smart scientists. There's always going to be an intelligent class. There's always going to be a class who are charismatic, leaders of men, military guys. There's always going to be someone who can make money, right? You know, and there's always going to be people who can't do anything but manual labor. So the varnas are going to be there. They're in there in every society, but they're not daiva. They're not centered on Krishna. It's a complete corruption. So now, how does this relate to us? Well, There is a verse, you know, Krishna consciousness is ultimately beyond all of this varnashram. You have to realize that. And the essential factor in Krishna consciousness, the practice of yoga, is chanting the holy name. Whether you're chanting japa or whether we're chanting like we will in a few minutes in kirtan, there's no question of varna and ashram. You know, there's no question of it. Oh, this is a Brahmin chanting, this is a chant. Forget it. It's just living entities chanting. You know? It's a chant, it's beyond that. So ultimately, Varna and Ashram is simply a way of organizing society so everyone can make spiritual progress. That's the whole purpose of it. Krishna created it. Chaturvarnya Maya Shristam Guna Vibhagasha. I created this for society because Krishna's concerned. So Swadharma, now in one verse, Narada Muni says in the fifth chapter, first canon, Chakva Swadharmam Chadanam Bhajan Hare Bhajan Bhakvota Pateta Toyadi Yatva Kvavabhadram Abudamushikim Korvota Apto Abhajatam Swadharmataham. Here he gives the beautiful contrast. He says, if someone gives up their place in Swadharma, you know, and simply serves Krishna, chaktva Swadharma, chadanam bhajang hare bhajan, and simply worships the lotus feet of Hari, but doesn't follow the course all the way, only stays, you know, in the Krishna conscious movement for 2 years, 1 year, and then he goes off and does who knows what. Where is there any loss? There's no loss because whatever you do spiritually is with you eternally. That you will keep with you when you go to your next lifetime. Everything else is lost. You can't take it with you. But you can take with you your spiritual assets. Nehabukamanashosti, Pratyavaya Navijite, Krishna says right here in the second chapter. So, but on the other hand, someone who very nicely follows his Swadharma is a really good, you know, on the material side, the Brahmin or Kshatriya, but has no bhajan, there's no connection to Krishna, where is there any gain? Yeah, there's no gain. That's from it. It's another verse, but it's like, because it's all left behind. It doesn't get you one step closer to your goal in life. See, this is you know, a very important point that we have to look at, well, what is the goal we're doing here? What is the purpose? You know, in every sphere of life, we have to consider, well, where is this taking me? You know, what's going to be the result of this? If you think of the implication of your actions, that's Krishna consciousness, karma. You know, that's the whole idea of law, of moral law, of that there is a law in this world. I mean, this you see, going back again to the social environment we live in. Think about this. There, you know, for the last how many years? I mean, I remember reading about this in the 80s. About the buildup of carbon in the atmosphere and the harm that it's going to do, but nobody was doing anything about it. But gradually, now suddenly people are like, God, you know, there's global warming, there's all of these extreme weather things going on, and it's actually happening. But there are a whole bunch of people who are fighting against that, right? And there's a lot of people who, you know, yeah, but I can't really worry about it, right? So this is like different modes of nature. There are those who are highly concerned about the fate of the world, not just me, right? I'm concerned that, you know, that our the children and children's children are going to be living in a world that is much different than we have because of what we're doing now. We're putting too many pollutants in the world, in the earth thing. And so they try to do so, even at the sacrifice of their own benefit. You know, spend so much time, so much effort in order to make people aware. You know, there are other people who may know about that, but they're too much involved in their own life to really do anything about it. And there's other people who say, "Who cares?" And I just make the rent and, you know, pay the bills and get drunk on a weekend. You know, different modes of nature. Isn't it? The mode of ignorance is more or less now, today, and maybe next week and next month. That's as far as I want to know. I mean, there's billions of people like that, living hand to mouth, you know. So, but the most intelligent people are thinking not even for, you know, this week, month, year, or lifetime, but for eternity. And also thinking, you know, as Prabhupada is, and Krishna is here, about the best thing for society as a whole. Because after all, when you look at this pollution that goes on, and global warming and all these problems, the root cause of it is, what can you say, overconsumption. Is that if people live simply, just you know, put it to rest, no one needs to eat meat. I'm sorry, it's totally unnecessary. I can say that by pratyaksha, by direct experience. 40 years of vegetarian, feel great. So there's no reason to eat meat. If that one thing would happen, global warming would practically go away, right? What to speak of all the bad karma for killing all those poor cows and the diseases and the subtle things, the emotional things, the wars come because people are eating meat. You know, there's subtle laws there. I mean, you can measure it. I perfectly personally experienced after months of being a vegan and a raw foodist, what to speak, you know, of eating meat again. This goes back to the 70s. Just the feeling I had, you know, suddenly all this passion and this anger and this thing was welling up in me. You know, what to speak of someone who every day is eating that. So that would solve so many problems. It's possible. It could be done tomorrow. But no, people are addicted. You know, there's money to be made, billions of dollars to be made in the meat industry. And all of this overconsumption, who needs it, you know? You don't need it. It's a simple lifestyle. So that's the root cause of it. So it really is a spiritual problem. If Krishna consciousness would spread widely, people would be satisfied with so much less. They'd live a more natural, healthy, simple lifestyle. You know, that was Prabhupada's idea. Varnashram, fine. Daiva Varnashram. You know? The other problems would be solved. You know? Depression? Who's depressed? You know, you're depressed. You have a nice big kirtan. You know? With a big holiday feast. You know? Love and trust. I'm telling you, it would go. The depression is internalized shochitam. This shochitam word. You know, anxiety, you know. Isolation, alienation. It's, you know, all these problems would evaporate. It's like the fog. Any questions on this? How do you?
I know that Prabhupada wrote in the Bhagavatam itself that by following karma, even materially will be benefited. All the rivers will be full of. There'll be fresh water. The mountains will be full of gems. There's grains in the fields.
Yeah, but the point is there's a, you know, when you actually understand how the world works or how the universe works, there are all these higher forces going on. You know, that people don't realize. We call the devas. You know, we're part. We each sitting here are part of what's called the universal form, the Vishwarup. You know, our bodies. What are they? They're earth, water. That's part of the universal form. And the devas are also part of that universal form. So it's just like a big organism of which we're part. You know, and we're disturbances. You know, people don't realize that. So in the next chapter, Krishna will talk about that. You know, in subsequent chapters, very interesting. He denigrates, seventh chapter, ninth chapter especially, worship of the demigod, anyone else but me. But in the third chapter, he says, Brahma, when he created this world, he also created this cycle of sacrifice. You know, you recognize the importance of these higher forces. And therefore, you know, when Krishna is worshipped, who's the master of all the devas, then everyone becomes satisfied. There's a verse, that verse, yata taro mula nishechanena. It means if you water the root of the tree, then the branches, the leaves, fruits, and flowers are watered. If you feed the stomach, then the whole body is nourished. Similarly, if you worship Krishna, the root of all existence, all the devas are worshipped. That's the actual meaning of the last line of that verse. Tathaiva sarva hanumanchateja. So what does that mean? It means that exactly all of, you know, the water, the sun, the air, all of those are controlled by beings. You know, that's provided for us in the proper proportion, nicely. And that's shown, the example is Yudhisthira's reign. It rained just at the right time, the cows are very happy, the milk was flowing, you know. It sounds amazing, but that's the way the world works. So, and when you violate that, when you don't care, who cares about that now? You know? Then what do you get? You know, huge destruction from tornadoes. Oh my God, where is it happening? Oh, it just may be an accident. No, it's not an accident. You know, these are results coming. You know, the earthquakes, yeah, coming, the disease, and now the radiation is flowing. You know, I'm telling you. You know, it's a sinful reaction. So yes, there is a higher order of things. And this culture recognizes that. And if your life is centered on worship of Krishna, then everything else is taken care of. You don't have to worship other devas. But if you ignore God and you ignore the devas, you're on your own, and this is the result. You know, a chaotic society. Yes, Bhaktivedanta.
So we're on this planet, we're in these bodies, and there are a lot of demons, like you're saying. Can we have like an isolated gems in the mountains, rivers flowing?
No.
Can we have like a...
There can be little microcosms.
Yeah.
But you really can't unplug from the greater society. Just like, you know, I hate to say it, you know, this Fukushima, they're spewing out. You know, you don't hear about it. There's all this suppression of knowledge. You know, there's a meltdown. 90 minutes after the pumps were shut down, there's a meltdown what do they call them? Yeah, the generator stations, you know. The meltdown is very dangerous. It means that there's nothing cooling those things, and they start spewing out all of this radiation, which goes up into the air, high in the air, and comes where? California. The whole West Coast. I mean, it's not like, you put a Geiger counter and it's going to start, you know. But there are particles of things that are spewing out. So you can't separate yourself from the rest of humanity. We can have our little examples. We've tried. We haven't done very well in America. Shivaram Swami is doing something really important in Hungary, you know, showing how the self-sufficiency and stuff like that. And they're trying to do some things in India. But ultimately, you can't. It has to be an example. And mostly, we are concerned with preaching in the cities. It'll always be like that. That was Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's injunction. You know, he left Mayapur and came to Calcutta to preach. You know, this was a big thing to start a center, even though it's much more hectic there and not as conducive to, you know, sattvic, because it's needed. It's so much needed. So, you know, on an individual level or a small level, we can practice as far as possible and show how one can live, even in a big city, in a calm, self-controlled way and be on a transcendental platform. That's a very important example to give as well. But we should also have farms where cows are protected and life is very peaceful and nice. That can be there to a small degree. Okay, should we do one more? A couple more. Okay, so he's telling Arjuna basically that this is a great fortune for you. And this is Kshatriya talk now. He's talking. Yadvichaya chopapannam.
Yadvichaya chopapannam.
Swagadvaram apavatam. Sukina chatriya parta. Labante yudhamidrisham. O Partha, happy are the Kshatriyas to whom such fighting opportunities come unsought, opening for them the doors of the heavenly planets. Purport. As supreme teacher of the world, Lord Krishna condemns the attitude of Arjuna, who said, "I do not find any good in this fighting. It will cause perpetual habitation in hell." Such statements by Arjuna were due to ignorance only. He wanted to become nonviolent in the discharge of his specific duty. For a Kshatriya to be on the battlefield and to become nonviolent is the philosophy of fools. In the Parashara Smriti, or religious codes made by Parashara, the great sage and father of Vyasadeva, it is stated, Kshatriyo hi praja rakshan shastrapani padandayan nirjitya padasainyadi chittim dharmena paliyat. The Kshatriya's duty is to protect the citizens from all kinds of difficulties. And for that reason, he has to apply violence in suitable cases for law and order. Therefore, he has to conquer the soldiers of inimical kings, and thus, with religious principles, he should rule over the world. Considering all aspects, Arjuna had no reason to refrain from fighting. If he should conquer his enemies, he would enjoy the kingdom. And if he should die in the battle, he would be elevated to the heavenly planets, whose doors were wide open to him. Fighting would be for his benefit in either case. So he was thinking, as the Prabhupada says in the next purport, that by not fighting, he would avoid going to hell. But it's just the opposite. By not fighting, he would go to hell, you know, or commit sin. He would be sinning by refusing Krishna's order. But by fighting, it was a win-win situation. That was what this idea is. If you win the battle, then you'll enjoy the kingdom. If you lose and die, well, you go to heaven and you'll enjoy there. So you can't lose. In other words, by working according to his Swadharma, in the realm of Krishna's order, everything is auspicious. And that's also for us too. Even though there may seem to be some material downside, just like the outsiders who see the Hare Krishnas, they think, what are you guys doing? You know, you're not going to school, you're not making any money, you're not going out with girls, you're losers, you know. And then maybe say, no, actually, you're losers. Yeah. Who's the, like Prabhupada said, who's crazy? You know, the famous who is crazy. So he would point out, well, if you go to the actual, you know, insane asylum, you'll find people who are absolutely convinced that they're Jesus or that they're Napoleon or that they're Jack the Ripper or who knows who, right? So, and they live that way. They need restraint. They need sedation, right? So, isn't that the same? You know, where everyone is convinced, oh, I'm, you know, Bob Jones, 33-year-old resident of San Diego. No. You're wearing a costume that may be named Bob Jones, right? It has a birth certificate. It has a driver's license with your picture on it. But we just read the verse, Vasangsi Jirnani Yatari, that that's nothing but a set of clothes. You know, I don't know if you've ever done this, but this morning, you know, sometimes it happens during japa. I'm sorry, this is the vision I was getting. Is that, you know, I don't know how many of you had this experience in grade school or high school, where they have like the visible man. You know, you can see the muscular structure and you can take them apart and there's the bones inside, you know, and this way you learn it. Oh, yeah, there's kidneys here and there's all this stuff. You know, it's a learning tool, right? So I was just seeing, well, this is what we are, you know? If everyone's skin was suddenly transparent, would you really be attracted? Wouldn't they be like, ah? Oh, no. You know? Or, you know, if you see a skeleton, you know, that's like a grotesque, or like the you know, the favorite thing where they have on the skull, right? Oh, it's horrible, you know. But all of us have skulls. We're walking around with skulls in us. But it's covered over, so it, you know. So what is it that makes us even able to live for, you know, in a society like that? Because we don't see the reality. You don't see the reality. And it's the spirit that moves everything. Because there's an element of Krishna there. The only thing attractive in this world is Krishna. And everything that's, you know, that's a reflection of Krishna's beauty, that's attractive. So we're a little bit like Krishna. A little bit. You know, we have the eyes, you know, and everything, the personality. But really, you know, just if you would, you know, perform a thought experiment. Just try to see me, you know, as the bones and the muscles moving now and in the skull, okay? You see? But isn't that's reality, isn't it? So what is it that makes it, you know, not so repulsive? Is the soul in there? As soon as the soul leaves, oh my God, it's a dead body. You know, you have to, you know, do something. but you see the illusion that let's be honest. There's a tremendous illusion in sex attraction, because you have to forget. You can't be thinking, oh my God, there's a skull in there. There's all these bones. But isn't that reality? Isn't that what's really there? I mean, let's be honest. So, this morning I was kind of thinking like that. Well, what's really to be attractive in this material world? You know? I know the Buddhists, I've heard that the Buddhists, you know, for their monks and everything, they have an exercise like that. If you start getting, you know, attracted to the opposite sex, just visualize the bones inside, and that'll cut it off, you know. So anyway... But still, with all of that, that attraction is still there, you know, because that's what it's built in. We're born addicts. You know, sometimes these unfortunate kids are actually born with cocaine addiction because the mother's addicted. So similarly, just being born in human bodies, or any bodies, you have a built-in thing at a certain point in time where you're attracted to the opposite sex. But it's an addiction. It's an addiction that can be cured. I mean, you know, it's unnatural for the soul to be tied up in this material body and be addicted like that. That is the main attraction. But it has to be managed. Just like some strong addiction, you can't just go cold turkey. The person will freak out, right? So you have to have a process of gradual weaning away. And that's called varnashram. And that's called the way of society. Yes, there's marriage, it's good, but there's a way of of doing it in such a way that gradually you transcend it. And the children raised in that family are also transcendentalists. So the purpose of life is not lost. The greatest disaster is to forget completely about your spiritual nature and simply become absorbed in material things. And that's what's going on everywhere. So this is the reformatory here. This is the rehab center right here at ISKCON, where you can come and you can start to get rid of it. And even just a little bit free of addictions. You see how you become nice and joyful and peaceful? Just look, you see the ashram dwellers here. You know, there's a difference, a different species almost, a different mood. So he's talking now, he's talking Kshatriya talk now. Look, what's not to like? You know, this is, first of all, this comes unsought. You didn't ask for it, it's given to you, this battle. And it opens the doors to heaven. It's a righteous battle, you can't lose. You go to heaven or you enjoy the kingdom. So therefore, fight it. Okay, one more. We'll do this next one because it's real short. Atat chetvam imam dharmyam.
Atat chetvam imam dharmyam.
Sangramam na karishyasi.
Sangramam na karishyasi.
Tatak swadharmam kirtim cha.
Tatak swadharmam kirtim cha.
Hitva papam avapsisi.
Hitva papam avapsisi.
If, however, you do not perform your religious duty of fighting, then you will certainly incur sins for neglecting your duties and thus lose your reputation as a fighter. And that's like anathema to Kshatriya. The reputation is everything. Purport. Arjun was a famous fighter, and he attained fame by fighting many great demigods, including even Lord Shiva. After fighting and defeating Lord Shiva in the dress of a hunter, Arjun pleased the Lord Shiva and received as a reward a weapon called Pashupata Astra. Everyone knew that he was a great warrior. Even Dronacharya gave him benedictions and awarded him the special weapon by which he could kill even his teacher. That's Dronacharya. So Arjun was credited with so many military certificates from many authorities, including his adoptive father, Indra, his actual father, the heavenly king. But if he abandoned the battle, not only would he neglect his specific duty as a Kshatriya, but he would lose all his fame and good name and thus prepare his royal road to hell. In other words, he would go to hell not by fighting, but by withdrawing from the battle. So that you can see this is Kshatriya talk. Any Kshatriya would say, oh, okay. You're right. I'm going to fight, you know. So that's, for these few verses, Krishna then goes back to more or less this Kshatriya through Kshatriya talk. And it's true that Arjun's auspicious on all levels, both the material and the spiritual, Arjun's best course of action is to fight in this battle, which he will do at the end. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.